This building podcast is brought to you by Fenwick Elliott, the construction and energy law specialists. To find out more, go to www.fenwickelliott.com. Hello and welcome to this latest building podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Harris, Building's digital editor. Coming up on today's podcast.
I think that, you know, the challenges in a way stem from the fragility of the original fabric. And
Elizabeth Hopkirk talks to John McCaslin about the challenges his practice faced in converting heritage houses into a state-of-the-art museum in Doha, Qatar. Also coming up,
Heather Wick divides opinion amongst architects, but I think Coldrop's Yard is a wonderful, really inventive and blisteringly creative way of handling conservation.
BD's architecture critic Ike EJ pours through the REBA National Award winners and ponders which of the nominated projects are contenders for this year's Stirling Prize shortlist, to be announced later this month. That's a taste of what's to come in this episode. Stick around. But first, the story of struggling contractors is not really a new topic in construction. But in recent years, and even recent months, we've seen share prices plummet, CEOs ousted, and even firms going bust. Joining me are Jordan Marshall and Will Ng from the Building News team. Afternoon, both of you. Okay, what's the latest? Who are the big ones that are struggling at the moment?
Okay, well, I think maybe one of the biggest ones to be struggling is Kia.
Yeah, there's, ongoing rumblings at Kia, and the politics have actually been playing into it a bit in the last week or so, with John Trickett posting a series of questions about both Kia and Interserve.
Who is John Trickett?
Oh, so Shadow Cabinet Minister.
Okay.
He was asking the Cabinet Office to essentially please explain their relationship with Kia. And perhaps the most interesting thing that I took away from all of that was the decision by the Cabinet Office to say that they have not and are not planning any investigation into Kia's payment terms, particularly on public sector jobs.
Mm.
Will, I know that you've written about this before. They've got really poor, well, technically illegal payment terms.
Yeah, I mean, the average payment terms on public sector contracts is well over 30 days. And, you know, on public sector contracts, you have to have 30-day clauses. That's in the law. So, I mean, there's no sort of legal mechanism to basically, like, enforce or to punish Kia. But it's strange that they wouldn't take the bite on this. I think for them, they're very much focusing on this September deadline where they've said if firms are not paying well enough, and well enough, they say, means 95% of invoices paid within 60 days, then, you know, they might be barred from work. Whether this will actually happen, we'll have to see.
Well, you looked into this, didn't you, not too long ago, and you found that no one is doing that in construction.
Yep, some people are getting closer than others. Skanska and Mace are a lot closer than Kier and Langer Rourke, but at the moment, no one is hitting this target, according to their own payment data.
And it's also, I mean, I think the key words in that are might or could suspend. It's like at the moment, they're not enforcing the 30-day thing. So what's the difference going to be come September? I don't know. It's going to be a bit disheartening for the smaller contractors who are, you know, the subbies. And as we're seeing, the problems that are at the top level are flowing down to smaller firms as well.
Yeah. I mean, they've certainly cranked up the rhetoric on this, but we just have to wait and see whether anything will happen and what effects that will have on the big contractors. If they do have to start paying more quickly.
I would think that different contractors would be, well, smaller contractors would be sort of, you know, feeling a bit at their wits' end about it all. Like, there's been a lot of talk for a long time, and I know there are other things dominating the political landscape at the moment, obviously Brexit and uncertain leadership, theoretically uncertain leadership battle, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, there's been an outstanding consultation on retentions for nearly 18 months. It closed last January and government still hasn't responded to it. It's pretty poor if you're saying that you're planning on, like, either respond to it and say we've decided it's not an issue, we're just going to ignore it, or respond.
Absolutely. And, you know, contractors go bust all the time, small little firms. Today, as we record this, the oldest building company in the UK has gone bust, but it's one of many, so it does make a difference.
And of course, in this week's Building magazine, you'll be able to read all about the demise of Shaler Group, who, I mean, they're not that small. They're quite a big contractor. They're in Building's top 150 contractors, you know, and they've seen struggles as well. And it is, like you say, Jordan, it is filtering down.
And in terms of Shaler, like, they're, in turn, they're creditors could be on the hook for up to £25 million, plus, you know, their staff, who are apparently owed more than £1.8 million. They weren't paying uni fees for students who they were supposed to be paying uni fees for, who luckily got their fees waived but otherwise wouldn't have been able to graduate. And we're talking about skills. I don't know, it wouldn't be in a particularly attractive industry for me at the moment.
No, and, you know, those creditors, some of that will be the banks, but some of them will be trade creditors that are owed money on jobs. And that's really sad.
Moving on, Will, you've been you know, keeping track on various, you know, things like share prices of some of the bigger contractors, and another firm that you've been looking at is Costain as well.
Yeah, I think Costain was a bit of a shock, actually. But in terms of the big boys, that's maybe one of the bigger stories of this week. Costain issued a profit warning. It said its half-year profit would be 10 million lower than it previously thought, and it said its underlying profit for the year might be up to 28% lower than thought. And it was punished for this by investors. So it closed on Friday, its share price 44% down on what it was previously, which is a big cut. Since then, Alex Vaughan, their new CEO, has gone to the stock exchange and sort of delivered this strategy for how he wants to do more higher margin business, more consultancy, more asset optimization, more like digital stuff, and sort of move away from the nitty gritty of contracting. Not completely. He says he wants about 45% to be the sort of complex infrastructure contracting work, whereas now it's more like 65%.
Well, we'll have to watch this space, really. Of course, you can find out more and keep up to date with all of the contractor struggles and goings on at building.co.uk. And also later this month, I should add, we will be delving into this year's top 150 contractors. Will and Jordan, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Published, as you say, a book on the Musharraf Museums, as they're called, which are...
That's British architect John McCaslin. Here he is talking to BD's Elizabeth Hopkirk about the challenges his practice faced in transforming four heritage houses in downtown Doha, Qatar.
Different aspects of daily life in Doha and Qatar, and they form a sort of ensemble of buildings in the Musharraf downtown development, which is right at the heart of the city.
Brilliant. What about the specific design challenges of working with a heritage project? But this is not a type of project that's often done in Qatar, I understand.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think the key thing was on the Musharraf site, which is about 35 hectares in area, the master plan is about 100 buildings in total, so there's a lot of buildings, and there's quite a complex master plan of a network of both vehicle streets and pedestrian walkways, and it's promotes itself as being in a way the world, or rather Middle East, first sustainable downtown redevelopment, which is great. And one of the key aspects of the whole project was to retain a small number, because there were only a small number of the key historic buildings. And so the key challenge for us with those buildings was, in a way, to find a way of preserving the authenticity of the buildings, and to in a way to reflect the changes that were being made to turn them into museum environments seamlessly. So as the changes are almost invisible. So a lot of the strengthening of the buildings, which was required because they were effectively kind of adobe construction, was critical to make them seismically safe, to knit in new services, which is obviously critical for museum environments, and also to create a number of new spaces, both above grade and below grade, to allow different sorts of museum environments. So, for instance, in one of the museum houses, which is in Jamwood House, we built this sort of vast below ground exhibition, temporary exhibition hall, with 25 meter spanned concrete beams. So forming that sort of space below, immediately below a fairly kind of delicate piece of adobe construction, and threading in all of the required services was in fact pretty challenging. But I think the result is amazing. I mean, the buildings look, you know, as if very little has happened to them, but in fact, behind the scenes, a great deal has happened.
Mm. And what about the construction challenges? Because you're working in an extreme climate. Can you tell us about how you solved those problems and came up with a LEED Gold building?
Well, I think that, you know, the challenges in a way stem from the fragility of the original fabric and you know, pretty, you know, seamlessly inserting, for instance, you know, recessed concrete frames that are invisible to the at surface level, to rebuilding, you know, some of the delicate timber roofs and ceilings, lattice ceilings, and reinstating what had previously existed. So that sort of dismantling, strengthening, and then in a way reconstructing what's been temporarily removed was probably one of the great construction challenges. And then feeding in services, both where we need air conditioning for environmentally controlled spaces in most cases, and using and in some cases exploring one element, for instance, a house called Radwani House, where we've effectively put no servicing in whatsoever. So it's in the height of summer when it's 40, 45 degrees externally. We have challenged ourselves to try and find ways of allowing the interior of that house to provide as much a kind of naturally ventilated and cooled interior. And so we've tried to show degrees of environmental, we've used differing degrees of environmental control in order that the visitors can experience different environments, the natural environment in Radwani House to the obviously the heavily serviced environments in one or two of the other elements in the museums.
Mm. Yes, because before air conditioning was invented, early builders in very hot countries had worked out a sort of natural passive strategy.
They had worked out passive strategies, which in a way at Radwani is we have sort of reintroduced by opening up some of the, particularly the voids, vertical voids, in order to get to exploit as far as possible the breezes from across the site. And it sort of works, you know, you definitely get tempered environments by the passive measures that we've used.
And who did you work with? I gather you engaged local craftsmen.
Well, we did. Yeah, we did. We worked with, there was a series of main contractors, there was a series of engineers and associate architects, so people at Bureau Happold were involved, from the UK as sort of critical partners in a number of the projects. But we used craftsmen from some of the other projects that had been ongoing in Doha. There's a particular development outside the city which involve effectively reworking some of the existing crafts. There's Al Zubara, which is the World Heritage Site, where a number of the artisans came from. So as much as possible, we used local labour who obviously understood those techniques and engaged them as part of the construction process.
fascinating project. And then you brought in, as you said, who were the main contractors?
Well, there was a range of different. There was a whole range of different contractors who were involved in packages. But the principal contractor was Turner International Middle East, or TIME as it's called. They were the overall management contractors for the whole of the project. So the 110 buildings all come under their, you know, their overall management. And then there is a bunch of different either general contractors for individual buildings or package contractors for all of the elements. And about 25,000 at the peak, about workforce of about 25,000 people. So it's been a huge endeavor over about 10 years and nearing completion as a development with a number of not just the cultural projects, but schools, which we build, a mosque, a couple of hotels, some of the residential projects, some of the offices and retail space. And amazingly, Elizabeth, I mean, it's a development that's built at one time, so it's not phased in a way as any normal development would be, where it's phased and buildings are only built when there's an end user. It's a lot of the whole site will be complete at one time. It's albeit phased, but not phased as tenants appear, but phased just construction to make constructional sense. So in that regard, it's completely unique to.
And have you enjoyed the experience?
I have. I think it was a 10-year project. I was there last about a month ago to visit the Mandarin Hotel and the museums again. And the Mandarin's just opened, and it was absolutely brilliant. You know, it was across this wonderful square, Al Bahara Square, which Michel Massessian designed. And it was just fantastic. It was a kind of warm but not horribly warm evening. It was, the light was great. The sense of this complete project was very apparent. There's a number of visitors, people walking around. I thought it was brilliant. We've enjoyed it greatly. Absolutely fantastic.
Wonderful. And as if jumping off a plane from there wasn't enough, you've just come back from New York. Very briefly, tell us, you're setting up your second international office there.
Well, we set up a studio in Sydney about 18 months ago, for starting with one project, which was Sydney Central Station, which is a little at King's, I guess it's very like the King's Cross project, which has been fantastic. And then I've always thought the idea of opening a studio in New York is something that we just must try. And so I got licensed as in New York, and we're in the process of just getting fully incorporated. So by the autumn, we should be up and running.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, John.
Brilliant.
Now, the Reba National Award winners is typically seen as the longlist for the Sterling Prize. Joining BD's Elizabeth Hopkirk is our resident architecture critic, Ike EJ, who has pored through the winners to see which projects could make the Sterling Prize shortlist later this month.
Well, Ike, you've been to more of these buildings than most people. It's a really interesting list, I think, isn't it? There's three awards apiece for Mole Architects, quite a small practice, and Howarth Tompkins, a favourite for the award, and a winner in 2014 with the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool. What do you make of the list?
It's the long list, obviously, for obvious reasons. There's a lot more in here than the short list, so there's more to please more people, I suppose. But the long list is always quite encouraging, because it's quite a good concentration of what's been great this year, I suppose, about British architecture. It is good. Mole is, as Elizabeth said, they're a small practice, but they're punching above their weight, if you want to use that awful geopolitical term, in terms of their representation on the list. The key one, I suppose, in terms of kind of national significance, being Marmalade Lane Co-housing in Cambridge, which is, obviously, co-housing's been around for a while in this country. It's nowhere near as entrenched as in other countries like Canada and Germany, but it is growing. And Marmalade Lane co-housing represents, I believe, the largest example of it in the UK so far. So it's kind of a step up for for that sector. So it's good they're represented, and obviously Haworth Tompkins represented with three schemes as well. As Elizabeth said, they won the Sterling Prize in 2014 for the Everyman Theatre, which personally is one of my favourite Sterling winners over the past few years. So yeah, it's good to see them represented here again.
A third of the list this year is refurbishment, which is seems significant and welcome, given the challenges that we're facing. What do you... You've been to some of these buildings. Talk us through the ones that you have found the most interesting.
Okay, all right. First I'd say it's great that refurbishment is so well represented in the awards. And as well as that, there are some standout refurbishment schemes as well, I think. Starting off with Haworth Tompkins, who we just mentioned. They've done the Battersea Arts Centre, which is a wonderful project. You may recall the fire there some years ago.
Yeah.
And they've essentially restored the building beautifully, but they've done it in that kind of way. We did a piece on it earlier called a kind of glamorous decay or retained decay. So it's not a kind of pristine refurbishment, but it's something that kind of reveals echoes of the kind of deterioration that's happened in the past, but in a kind of usable, functional new way for the building to be reused again. Which also is another theme, another standout refurbishment scheme here, which is Alexandra Palace in London, where the theatre, which I believe, if I remember, hasn't been in use for some 80 years, has been brought back to life. And it's a wonderful, really kind of virtuoso, kind of uplifting, kind of whimsical scheme where elements of degradation have been retained, but the key point being that the theatre has been brought back into use. And there's also two standout kind of national projects, which you don't often see kind of in Sterling shortlists. Painted Hall in Greenwich. See, a Christopher Wren masterpiece, one of the finest Baroque interiors, if not the probably finest Baroque interior in the country, has been restored by Hugh Broughton Architects. So that would be a good opportunity to see how kind of modern interventions have helped extend the life of a revered, wonderful historic building. And also, an even older building, we see Westminster Abbey here. It's not really a refurbishment, but the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Galleries, actually, yeah, it is a refurbishment. They've been fitted into the triforium of the Abbey. And as well as that, a new tower has been erected externally by Ptolemy Dean. Now, you can't get more historically significant than this. It's the first new addition, well, brand new addition, to Westminster Abbey since the completion of the West Towers in 1745. So that's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So imagine an extension to the Taj Mahal, say. That's the kind of significance of this kind of project. So refurbishment, yes, making a really big and welcome impact, I think, in this year's long list.
Now, there's also a lot of housing on this shortlist, on this long list. We've had really good housing schemes shortlisted over the last few years, but incredibly, no housing has won the Sterling Prize since 2008, and Accordia in Cambridge. Could this be the year, Ike?
It could be, I think. I think Eddington is in here in various guises. Northwest Cambridge, kind of heroic regeneration, more redevelopment scheme, I suppose. Very high quality, lots of very good architects, a kind of very considered and inclusive public realm landscaping approach. And yeah, it's a kind of standout scheme example of how you basically extend a city. So it's good to see that represented here. Signal Townhouses by AHMM. The back-to-back housing reviled for very good reasons throughout much of the 19th and 20th century for awful insanitary conditions of housing for the working classes created as a result of the Industrial Revolution. So it's something that we've rejected rightly as a society, but it's now coming back into fashion with some very, very interesting kind of innovative schemes which are kind of turning the whole kind of back-to-back format on its head and creating interesting new housing types from it. So yes, there are some interesting housing elements here, but again, often with the Sterling long list and certainly the short list, it's the omissions which are rather more interesting than the what's been included.
Who should be on here that's not?
Well, Peter Barber, for one, I think. It's a shame. He's kind of a how's a maverick within the architecture world, if you like. He's spent many years plugging away at these wonderful, inventive, esoteric, but very kind of uplifting and schemes that aren't easy to classify, but bringing all kinds of references and typologies, and he creates wonderful, kind of very considered, very unique housing elements and enclaves and ensembles, and it's a bit of a shame that he hasn't been represented here again. Another omission as well is the RIBA seems to ignore the fact that housing for older people, or later living as it's more kind of fashionably called, is now a growing and significant sector in UK housing. And it also produces some exceptional examples of good housing architecture. Clients like Pegasus Life, schemes such as by Kofi Architects, I think it's Moore Park, apologies if I got that wrong, but those are some examples of some of the kind of really, really strong later living housing schemes, which are in many ways kind of becoming an exemplar for how other non-older people housing should kind of embrace or design new housing. So it's a bit of a shame that, once again, that doesn't appear to be represented here. But one significant housing scheme that is here, and it's good it is here, I suppose, is Goldsmith Street, which is in Norwich. It's the largest passive house scheme in the country. It's had several accolades. I believe it won our own BD Architect of the Year award. But it's a stellar scheme. As I say, essentially they've tried to come up with a high-performance conservation area. It's modern housing, terraced housing, but everything about it is about recreating streets, proportions, neighbourhoods, communities, but doing that within a kind of physical fabric that performs very well in terms of environmental standards and sustainability. So that is, I suppose, it's good to see that included here.
And that's Mikhail Richards, isn't it?
Mikhail Richards, it is, yes.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spotlight. Who should be on the shortlist?
Well,
or can you pick a winner?
Okay, well, I it's always tough to pick a Sterling winner because they tend to be unpredictable, but I'm going to give you three options, which I'm not saying they're going to win, but in fact, the fact I've said they should win will probably mean they won't. But anyway, in my opinion, these are, it's not the exclusion of anything else, but these are just three that stood out for me that could potentially be winners. The first is Cold Drops Yard, which is by Heatherwick. It's in King's Cross. And Heatherwick divides opinion amongst architects, but I think Cold Drops Yard is a wonderful, really inventive and blisteringly creative way of handling conservation. You have two railway sidings, which have been disused for several years, and he essentially takes a roof, joins them together in this kind of engineered, cantilevered kiss over a new kind of retail piazza. So it really shows you that conservation is not just about repairing lime plaster and replacing bricks. It can be a really kind of wonderful, inventive, and almost quite visceral and melodramatic and operatic way of reinterpreting old buildings. The other one I'd plump for is Eddington. Again, I've mentioned Eddington. It's a really heroic piece of new town planning and combining that with some exceptional new architecture as well, new public spaces. Obviously building on Cambridge's tradition of exemplary modern housing. Obviously we mentioned Accordia won the Sterling Prize 10 or 11 years ago. So yeah, I think Eddington, it comes in here under various guises, has a good chance of triumphing. And an outsider, which again may be a Marmite option, may not appeal to everybody, but it's got the kind of stellar stardust that it seems to appeal to the RIBA, is a V&A Dundee by Kenga Kuma and Associates, which is probably the standout cultural project of last year. Again, not to everybody's taste, but certainly for me, it was a really, yes, it's sculpture, it's a standalone building, it's not really something that goes in for contextual empathy, but it really makes a big kind of impression. It kind of heralds Dundee's regeneration of its waterfront as something that's definitely happening now and is going to be make a growing impact on the city in the future. And it's a very kind of sculptural, theatrical way of actually celebrating some of those old traditional themes within Dundee, such as the fact that the spot it was located at used to be a gateway to the water, the river, and then to the rest of the world. So essentially it's a giant archway, a giant gateway, reinterpreting that historic character. And yeah, because it's a big name architect and it's hugely expensive, it'll probably appeal to the RIBA judges. So there you go, that's my Three pennies worth.
That'll be the first Scottish sterling winner since the Scottish Parliament in 2008.
Ah, right. Ah, another building that didn't deserve to win, but there you go. That's my opinion. So.
Brilliant. Thanks, Hague. The shortlist is out on July the 18th, so not long to wait to find out if your tipped winners
don't come
are,
true.
Well, that's it for this week's Building Podcast, which was brought to you by Fenwick Elliott, the Construction and Energy Law Specialists. To find out more, go to www.fenwickelliott.com. As ever, please do let us know your thoughts and feedback on this podcast by leaving a review on iTunes or by emailing building@building.co.uk. Don't forget, you can listen back to our archive of podcast episodes from this series and before by going to building.co.uk/podcasts. Or by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks once again for listening. I'm Jamie Harris, Building's digital editor. Until next time.